Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to Meet the Masters of Income Property 2018. Thank you so much for joining us today.
We love leverage because leverage is a huge contributor to what I call the ultimate investing equation. And I haven't talked about this much, but years ago I did. So let me just say that and I'll get Patrick up here to introduce Ron Paul. The ultimate investing equation is basically this idea. You find good properties, good quality properties, 3 to 5 diverse markets around the country, linear markets that are conservative, that produce yield, that aren't possibly in the bubble territory like the West Coast and these crazy cyclical markets. You find those properties in those markets. You get a business partner to go in on the deal with you. And you say to the business partner, look, I found the properties, and I will put up 20% of the cash, and I want you to put up the 80%. You know I'm talking about the bank, obviously, right? The bank is your business partner. They put up 80% of the cash. You only put up 20% of the cash. And then you say, look, now I've got all this debt, and I mean, I know the utility of debt. It's a very powerful tool in our investing portfolio. But hey, I don't want to pay my own debts. That's really old-fashioned. I want to outsource my debts to another party called a tenant. Okay, so I'm going to give the tenant, in essence, the obligation to repay my debt for me. And then you say, well, look, that's not really enough. Okay, I own the properties. I got the business partner to put up 80% of the cash for the deal, so I could buy 5 times more than I normally could buy, right? You know, that leverage ratio. And then I outsourced the debt to the tenant and said, hey, tenant, you repay the debt for me, but then that's not good enough for me. You know, tenant, I really, in addition to repaying the debt to the bank for me, I'd like you to also give me a little extra per month. I need an extra $150 per month on each of these houses. So you get that, and now you got positive cash flow. And then you go to the government and say, look, I hate paying taxes, and income property is the most tax-favored asset class in America, and depreciation, if I can qualify for it, and that's a more complicated discussion that we've certainly covered in the past, and we will have our CPA, Ryan, talking, I think, tomorrow to you about tax stuff. And so we say to the government, look, I want to depreciate these properties through a phantom non-cash write-off. That phantom non-cash write-off depreciation, the holy grail of tax benefits, making income property the most tax-favored asset class in the world. And then, over the years, as the tenant is paying my mortgage off for me and I'm getting principal pay down, I also say to the general system of the Federal Reserve, Treasury, banking cartel, okay, I say to them, look, you know, I know you're inflating away the value of my savings, my stocks, my bonds, even the equity in my houses is being inflated away in a sense. So I want to implement this inflation-induced debt destruction plan. And I want to pay that debt back, or really have my tenant pay the debt back for me, in depreciating dollars that keep getting cheaper. So by the time, in the example I use, of the person who borrowed the money in 1972 at 7.37%, which was the interest rate back then, lived in the house, we discover by the time they made the last payment on that mortgage in 2001, and this happened to tens of millions of people. It's not a theory. It really happened to people, the hidden wealth creator. They basically got paid to borrow that money, and they got to live in a free house for 3 decades. You can't, it's a multidimensional asset class that nothing competes with that. That's why it's the most historically proven asset class in the world. And that's why we all love income property. But there is one thing better than income property. Anybody know what it is? I said it on the podcast. Chocolate.
Early on, even in the late 50s and early 60s, I got to reading about monetary policy. And for some reason, I became fascinated with that because I came across the Austrian economist who wrote about monetary policy, people like Murray Rothbard and Mises and Hayek, and they predicted things to come. And I watched it very carefully, especially in the 60s. And I was, you know, in 1944, when they passed the Bretton Woods Agreement, I was all of 9 years old. I remember a little bit about the UN and all coming in, but that was when they established the Bretton Woods Agreement. But in the 50s and the 60s, matter of fact, even in 1944, Henry Hazlitt, a very brilliant Austrian school economist and journalist, was reporting on the Bretton Woods. He says it can't work. It's going to fail. He says the people who get to issue the reserve currency of the world will issue too much money. And this whole idea that you could have a pseudo gold standard, that you could have a partial gold standard and turn it over, and we were the wealthy nations. That's why we got control of the reserve currency of the world. He said it would fail. So people watched that, and the black market, or the real market for the gold price, kept creeping up and creeping up, even though we declared that the dollar was as good as gold at $35 an ounce, which was fiction. And the predictions came true, and I remember the precise moment when that was announced. It was a Sunday night, and Richard Nixon made the announcement. And to me, it was a big deal, because it did turn out to be a moment when we flipped from a pretend partial commodity standard of money to a totally fiat money that we had control of. And it ushered in an age of what we're witnessing now, and why you have to talk about your investments dealing with inflation and government and all these things. But at that time, in 1971, gold was still valued at $35 an ounce. And, once the gold window was closed and they separated the dollar from gold, gold went from $35 an ounce up to $800 an ounce within a decade. And it's been doing this ever since, and now, of course, it's $1,350. So measurement of value, I believe, has to be a commodity, and too often governments abuse it. Governments always want to have monopoly control over things. They want the control of printing the money. So this standard, I believe, will end. The dollar probably will never not end. The pound was a reserve currency for a long time, and they still have pounds, but it's not the reserve currency of the world, and it's not a commodity dollar. It's not measured in a pound of silver, anything like that. So today, we have chaos. If you look at it, it is chaotic. And the worst part about the ability of government to have monopoly control over fiat currency, I believe, is the expansion of government. Because they get to run up the debt, they monetize the debt, they run a welfare state, a warfare state, and a militant state here in this country that undermines our liberties constantly. So if you care about liberty, we should start with getting rid of the Fed and having honest money. It isn't only those people who succumb to this temptation. It's the people who really run our government. And it has nothing to do with Republicans and Democrats. It has to do with the deep state. The deep state is out there. There are the military-industrial complex. There are the banking industry. There's all the secret organizations like the CIA. They don't protect us. They just undermine our liberties. They do more to undermine our liberties than ever protect us. So we have put up with this, but everybody said, you know what you guys need to do? You need more bipartisanship in Washington. I think that's completely wrong. I think there's way too much, because Pelosi and Boehner were good friends, and they'd probably laugh you know, every time they went and got the bill passed, which was the end of the year when everybody was looking, they'd come out with a bill like this and nobody read, and everybody got what they wanted in the leadership position. But it is the bipartisan things are like monetary policy. You know, it's endorsed by both parties. What about the attack on our civil liberties? This past week, they had the FISA courts. I don't know how many of you saw that. The FISA courts was to increase surveillance of the American people explicitly without a search warrant. I mean, it was just like taking the Fourth Amendment and tearing it up. It's been in shambles already, but it just got that much worse this week. And it was, there were some no votes, but it passed in the House rather easily with Republicans and Democratic leaders in the forefront to get it passed. Donald Trump came out a week or two before and saying that, we have to be a little bit careful about this, because somebody mentioned that that's exactly the people who were spying on him on this Russiagate. They were abusing the laws and spying and making up these stories and CIA and FBI involved. But then he turns around and he supported the bill, and he's going to sign the bill if it passes the Senate. But right now in the Senate, it might be held up for a while. There's a senator over there, I think I know his name pretty well. He says he might just... He just might put an obstacle in there. He may talk about that bill for so long and filibuster it. But anyway, the process continues. But the attack on liberty is incessant, and the level of liberty is very weak. We still have a lot of prosperity. But I do worry about the debt. I worry about sovereign debt. If you look at the statistic on how much debt has been run up, since this recent recession, since 2008, I mean, trillions and trillions of dollars. The Fed was involved with manipulating and passing out $15 trillion, not to bail out the mortgage people or the houses of people who were losing their jobs and losing their mortgage. They were bailing out the people who made billions of dollars on derivatives. And they were the ones that got the funding. But guess what? It's all done in secrecy. I've been working for a long time and have made some progress calling attention to the American people, because 80% of the American people say, why don't you audit the Fed? I said, that's a good idea. I've been working on that. But believe me, they're not going to let the Fed be audited, because that is where all the secrets are, especially of all the intermingling of these funds internationally. They cherish that secrecy. So we have things flipped upside down. The government was ordained to protect our liberties, the Fourth Amendment, your privacy, what you do is your own business. At the same time, the government was supposed to be open. Now, government's some private, and the government knows everything that we do. Everything. They have a record of what we do. And so I would think that the old-fashioned method of saying that privacy is the essence of liberty, and the government ought to be protecting our liberties, not deliberately destroying our liberties.
Charging order is a lien on distributions, meaning Mary, suing over the car wreck, would love to get up here, but she has to fight through the Wyoming LLC, right? Joe owns the Wyoming LLC, which owns the California LLC. So she has to fight to get at here through here. The Wyoming LLC says the exclusive remedy is the charging order, which is a lien on distributions, meaning the person has to wait to get paid. Do we like putting people in a position where they have to wait to get paid? Yes. Attorneys are on a contingency fee, right? When they bring a lawsuit on a personal injury case, they get a percentage of what they collect. Now, they know how to get insurance money. They're not so good at getting through these LLCs, right? Plus, if they have a case where there's plenty of insurance, the next case, do they want to mess with going to Wyoming, hiring an attorney there to get a charging order, do they want to mess with that? No, they'd rather go to the next case that has plenty of insurance money. All right? But we have California residents in the room. And the state of California says, all right, Joe, you're a California resident. You are managing the Wyoming LLC in California. Ergo, this Wyoming LLC is doing business in the state of California. Pay us the $800 a year for this one. And this infuriates a lot of people. California is still getting all the income. It's just now they want $800 here. We're already paying $800 here, right? But now they want it here. And this is a new rule in the last 2 years. California residents, I have to give them the bad news all the time. And it's interesting, the state legislature never approved this, right? This is just the Franchise Tax Board approving this without any sort of legislative authority. So the Wall Street Journal has described California's tax system as lawless taxation. All right, so that's what we have here. But the question is, now we have a Wyoming LLC qualified to do business in California. What law applies when you get sued? Wyoming or California? We don't have a case on it. What do you think a California court would say? California law. So what we do is we have a new program called Armor 8, where we utilize the Uniform Commercial Code and have the certificate here for this entity held in Wyoming. If that California attorney is coming after you, they have to hire an attorney in Wyoming to get at the interest in this entity. Do you think that an attorney that is working on insurance cases wants to bother with hiring a Wyoming attorney? No. This is a roadblock that we're putting up.
Two parts. Do you recommend member or manager managed being the first step? And then if we have the Wyoming LLC owning other LLCs, in the documentation for those secondary LLCs, is the Wyoming LLC the manager, or does your name show up on that? Or how? I guess if you could walk
through
questions. That a little bit.
Yeah, good questions. So let's deal with the first one. Do you like member managed or manager managed? And member managed means that an owner, a member of the LLC, is managing the affairs. And manager managed means it can be an owner or it could be an outside party. All right, so you have more flexibility with manager managed. And so most of our entities, we put in manager managed. 95% of the time, the member is the manager. But if there was ever a time when you brought in an outside manager to manage it, you'd have to go amend your articles. And so we like the flexibility of just saying manager managed. Now, the question is, like up here, where we have an Indiana LLC, New Mexico LLC, North Carolina LLC, do you make Wyoming the manager of these? You can, but in some states that would constitute doing business. So I like having you can be the manager of these entities up here. All right? So that's how we structure it.
This is a perfectly predictable housing demand. 3.3 million more under the age of 34, a decline of 45 to 64-year-olds. This is all just based on us getting a year older every year, and then a huge surge over the age of 65. You're going to be putting grab bars in your units. Perfectly predictable. You're going to be selling people who are completely retired and Social Security is going to, or renting. Social Security is a big part of their income. And they'll also have some gig income too, which you're going to have to figure out how to account for because they don't declare it all. Where's the growth going to be? And that map you see there, if you go from the southwest, Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, all the way through Florida and through the southeast, 42% of America lives there, but 62% of the growth is going there. And so we believe this is going to continue.
We're going to see 5.3 million more homeowners, 1.2 million more in the Southeast, 800,000 in Texas, 600,000 in Florida, 600,000 in the Southwest. And that's really just saying it's going to continue going on the way it's going right now. And about 7.2 million more renters. So when you're adding 5 million homeowners and 7 million renters, what happens to the home ownership rate? Falls. Okay? But 5 million more homeowners is good for the home builders. 7 million more renters is good for landlords. It's a good story for everybody. Home ownership is still desired. We have a huge consumer survey that we do, but I've looked at everybody else's. Everybody still wants to become a homeowner. However, when you're not getting the help and you're not saving and you haven't had the economic growth, it just gets more difficult. So this is our forecasted home ownership rate by 2025. So we're saying even those born in the 1980s, 52% of them will be homeowners by the age of 38. 63% of those born in the 1970s will be homeowners. Those are the ones who went through that horrible foreclosure experience. All of these, though, are 7 to 11% behind their parents. So unless there's a complete brand new government policy that comes in here that shifts things, the home ownership rate's going to trend down. And this is how we get to the 5.3 million of more homeowners. 10.6 million homeowners are going to pass away. Those are buying opportunities for you, but those houses need to get filled. And then 16 million more homes purchased, more people become homeowners. So let me move into the second takeaway, which is this 4-5-6 rule. Everything that people seem to ask about falls into four buckets: government policies, economic conditions, new technologies, or some sort of societal shift. But when you have discussions about these things, like what's the self-driving car going to do, for example, you need to look across the five life stages because it impacts each life stage differently. And I'm going to show you an example of this in a minute. To get to the six questions you're trying to ask is, who am I going to lease to? What do they want? Where, when, why, and how?
A couple things that I think are really, really important that, you know, that we always talk about at Rich Dad and we always stress. And this is probably, for me, capital gains versus cash flow. This is probably, for me, one of the most frustrating things that I see when I go travel. Because obviously I'm in a great position now to where, you know, our properties are distributing well over in millions every single month to our investors. We have incredible growth, and the properties have grown in both in equity, and the tenants are paying down our debt, and I'm going to walk through all that. And so teaching has become a choice. All my books, speaking, everything I do, I donate to charity 100%. And so I feel like some of the stuff that I've learned is it's a great platform. And so I want to thank Jason for being able to, for me to be able to come here and teach you some of the things that I've learned. And hopefully you can walk away with a few things that I've done, and I can share with you some of the mistakes I've made along the way. This is probably the biggest mistake I think that people make. And it's a really simple concept. And that is, people try to, it's happening right now with Bitcoin. You know, they're trying to time things. They're trying to time investments. And I'm telling you guys right now that what changed my life was sticking to cash flow. And I'm going to get into a little bit more about this in a minute. But if you can buy properties for cash flow, you don't have to worry about the market, okay? Because I was buying properties back in the 90s, early 2000s, and through the crashes, we were just fine because we never had too much debt on anything. Yes, our occupancies went down. Yes, people lost their jobs. All those things happen, okay? So 2007, 2008, 2009, we experienced the same thing that everybody else did. However, every single one of our properties did very well. Our cash flows were different. They were off. But we still were fine. because obviously everyone was experiencing the same thing. We didn't lose a thing. We kept paying our debt, and we kept acquiring properties all through that period of time. And the reason that we did it was because we weren't here. So everybody that was trying to flip their way to success, they lost a lot of almost everything that they had, in some cases, some of my friends. But the people who are cash flow based were the ones that survived. And so it's a very, very, very important concept, but it takes discipline to do it. And so every single property that I bought and every single community that we ever bought, whether it was a storage or an office building or a multifamily, it was always based on cash flow, because when you start to raise capital from investors, that's what they want. They want money. They want money for the money they give you. And if you're promising it to them on a capital gain strategy, it's risky. It's riskier. I'm not saying you can't do it. People make a lot of money doing it. But I'll tell you, and I touched just briefly, when I did condo conversions, in Scottsdale, which is where I live, in Tucson, in Las Vegas, and in Portland. We did very, very well. We bought multiple projects. We financed them all with Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch, and we hit the market perfectly. In 2000, we were buying properties and converting them to condos. In fact, we came to San Diego and we looked at multiple stuff actually right in this block to do the exact same thing. And we made a lot of money. We sold over 3,000 condominiums in a two-year period by taking apartments and converting them into condos. Here's what happened, though. I had three partners. Actually, I had five, because Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch were actually a partner, technically. But we made so much money that we, at the end of the run, which was about 2005, we didn't have hardly any real estate left, and we paid a majority of it to tax. So all of a sudden, I was sitting there at the end of 2004, early 2005, and I'm going, man, we just worked our butts off, and all we have is cash in the bank. And we don't own any real estate that cash flows. And so what I did the next cycle is focus on a cash flow strategy. And I'm telling you, from having done both, the cash flow strategy, it's harder. It takes a little more time. It takes a better team. But it's definitely worth it. If you really want to be financially free, a cash flow strategy is definitely the way to do it.
I want to just kind of run through a few of these other provisions. This is just to illustrate how much Congress loves you and loves what you're doing and wants you to spend more money doing it. Okay, so think about one of the most famous parts of this bill that you see in the press all the time is that you can no longer deduct more than $10,000 of property taxes that you pay on your own property. Okay, so my neighbor that lives down the street from me on Caroline Way in San Jose, California, pays $26,000 a year in property taxes on his house. Okay, so this is before even considering how much he pays in state income tax. His deduction is going to be limited in grand total from state income tax and property taxes to $10,000. Okay, it significantly devalues one of the benefits of being a homeowner. Well, guess what? This limitation on property tax deductibility does not apply to rentals. Okay, if you were an investor and owned my neighbor's house, the full amount of that property taxes would be deductible to you. Section 1031, these tax-free exchanges, if you thumb around a little bit on Reddit, you'll see that this is what Bitcoin guys, as they trade in and out of Bitcoin, they pick up Ripple or pick up Dogecoin or whatever, that they say, oh yeah, you know, I'm just doing a tax-free exchange of like-kind property. Well, part of the tax rule, part of the bill says that, you know what? 1031s are only available to real estate. So again, Congress must really love you. there's a new provision for corporations that they can only deduct 30% of their interest. They can only deduct up to 30% of their income in interest in any given year. Okay, so for some giant public utilities that were massively levered, they're going to have a severe restriction on how much they can deduct. Okay, guess what? Special carve out for real estate companies across the board. Lever up, lever away. REIT dividends. A REIT is a C corporation. It's a special kind of C corporation, but it's crazy to think that the dividends from a REIT are going to be treated as pass-through income for purposes of the pass-through deduction. But there it is, okay? There's some accounting methods that have been liberalized a little bit. Any house flippers in here? I don't know, maybe you don't want to raise your hand since this is one of Jason's events. But if you're a house flipper and you kind of consider yourself to be a dealer in property, so all the local market guys, if you're a dealer in property, it used to be anyone who had inventory, what we'd consider inventory property, you bought the property and then you could deduct it when you sold it, okay? Not the case anymore. If you're a small business, which is less than $25 million, you can deduct inventory when you buy it now. Okay, so for some house flippers that are clients of ours, I mean, this is huge because any taxable income they might have at the end of the year, they just go out and buy another property to get started the flipping process, wipes out all their taxable income that year. Conservation easements, I've mentioned this a few times. It's a charitable giving strategy where you go out to the county and you get a very special type of easement put on the property. And the value of that easement may be far excess of the land that you put the easement on through the magic of these tax rules and allows a supersized charitable deduction. A lot of us were concerned that these conservation easements were on the chopping block because they seem so ripe for abuse. People putting $100,000, buying a piece of property that was giving them a $600,000 charitable deduction. We were worried that those might be seen as abusive and get shut down. Congress goes through great painstaking detail to talk about this and what's going on out there and says that the Senate will take no action on this particular provision. So it's still there. Home mortgage interest limits, some of you may have heard, right? So that if you get a new mortgage on a home and it's in excess of $750,000, only a portion of that mortgage interest is going to be deductible. Again, how much, are there any limits on interest deductibility for rental properties? Nope. Okay. So another, put another tick mark in the column for real estate investors as opposed to homeowners. Certain non-residential property improvements can be depreciated faster. And then the home gain exclusion, which is the provision that allows you to not have to recognize gain on up to $500,000 if you're married of your principal residence gain. That remains untouched, which is, one of the biggest giveaways in the entire tax code, but that remains there. There was some discussion about it coming out. So lots in this new bill about real estate. And what our firm does is, we prepare taxes just like, the guy, your cousin Eddie that works down the street. But we are focused on real estate, and our clients represent, the clients that are involved in real estate, either as real estate investors or real estate syndicators, represent about 80% of our firm. So we spend quite a bit of time getting to know these rules and talking about how to make them work for you. But again, this was version 132 of why Congress loves what you do and is going to continue, at least from what we're seeing, rewarding those people who do what you do with some of the biggest tax incentives and tax breaks out there.
I was having a discussion that the next round of economic strife among U.S. households is not going to be purely an economic issue.
Yeah.
It's going to be a socioeconomic issue.
What does that mean?
That means that if you're Joe Q pension holder and your pension's just been annihilated because your pension has gone into alternative investments and plowed into illiquid investments and the passive investing takes a hickey, so you're the politician and you say your property taxes are going to go through the roof because we by law we have to top off this pension. Well, if you're Joe Q IRA or 401k holder and you've just been told that your property taxes are going up to top off the pension, but yet your retirement savings has also been annihilated, you're going to be mad. And if there's one thing that I write about that brings out anger, it is when I write about the pension system. Mm-hmm. Because people who don't have pensions to rely on do not want to have to bail out people who do.
Right.
And it will be something that is fought out in the judiciary. But, and this is something that was right out of Richard Fisher's mouth, was what is your greatest fear in your lifetime? This was 2010. Mm-hmm. And he said, and this was when there were riots in the streets of Athens because they were cutting people's pensions.
Yeah, austerity. Yeah.
And he said, my greatest fear is that we have these riots in our own streets. Yeah. And I can tell you, I mean, if you want to put a Goodyear blimp over the city of Chicago, that's where it will start.
Yeah. Chicago, Baltimore, St. Louis has got some
But you can talk about cities and Hartford, but you can't talk about states.
Right.
And there is no state bankruptcy law. Right. It does not exist. Yep. So how does the state of Illinois today declare bankruptcy? It's impossible. Mm-hmm. So there, my greatest concern is that this next round of household forced deleveraging is going to anger a lot of the same people that were called deplorable. Mm-hmm. And that anger is not going to go anywhere, but that it's going to escalate.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.